This is Corporate Watchdog Radio, bringing you news, interviews, and commentary on corporate sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
A global green deal.
By building a green infrastructure bank, we would be able to achieve economic stimulus opportunities for our society, as well as promoting low carbon emission infrastructure technology.
That's Bruce Kahn of Deutsche Asset Management, who we speak with today about their new report, Economic Stimulus: The Case for Green Infrastructure, Energy Security, and Green Jobs. We also speak with Michael Renner of the WorldWatch Institute for his proposal to the G20 summit for a global green deal. And lastly, we hear commentary from Mitch Anderson of Amazon Watch, produced in partnership with the Business Ethics Network.
But first, this week, instead of just headlines, we're trying out a new format, throwing in a bit of news analysis. Tell us if you like it by writing us at corporatewatchdogradio@gmail.com. Okay, here it goes. The Corporate Watchdog Radio news analysis for the week of November 19th. The cold weather finally came in this week. It's been unseasonably warm in Western Massachusetts, where we produce this show. It just didn't feel natural, with a cloying warm wind blowing about heaps of yellowed leaves on the ground. Just another local sign of the climate crisis. But although the evidence of its increasing impact can be found hidden in plain sight in the news, the climate crisis is still only on the margins of the radar screen of most Americans. In fact, it's getting pushed even more to the side. The Pew Research Center reported earlier this year that the number of Americans who believe the Earth is warming has dropped. One reason is, big media is still not connecting the dots. This week, wildfires were raging in California. Governor Schwarzenegger said his state's fire season has gone from a few months to all year round. What got buried in the media is that he also put the blame on global warming. This week, the UN released greenhouse gas inventory data for the past 16 years. The BBC reported it straightforwardly. Its headline read, "Emissions Up in Developed Nations." Now compare that to the headline in the New York Times, the U.S. paper of record. Quote, "Pollution has leveled off, but the figures have holes." Busy readers who just scan headlines could be reassured, for no good reason, as it turns out. The so-called leveling off was from averaging out emissions declines during economic downturns in the 1990s, but they've been rising smartly ever since. More worrying, the biggest recent increase came from economies in transition. Eastern European nations showed more than a 7% rise between 2000 and 2006.
Another reason for tuning out on the climate crisis is that Americans, like the rest of the world, are focusing on the tanking economy. When you've lost your job or the bulk of your retirement account, it's hard to think about anything else. But here again, the news media aren't connecting the dots. The dominant view bandied about is that dealing with the economic crisis trumps the climate crisis. The pundits are asking rhetorically, can the Obama administration and Congress really fulfill on promises for a sustainable energy economy? Can we afford to put a price on carbon? The implication is no. And no, too, for improving social sustainability by supporting programs that help the poor, working families, and a struggling middle class.
And take how the media is reporting on the current troubles in the auto industry, like the public radio show Marketplace. Under the headline, quote, "Obama meant it about CO2, the piece opens with, and I quote, "And now more damage for U.S. automakers' bottom lines." The article, which appears on the Marketplace website, reports on Obama's plan to overturn an EPA ruling forbidding California and three other states to impose stricter greenhouse gas emissions from passenger cars. Marketplace says that it will, quote, "increase pressure on the auto industry to develop efficient vehicles, which will cost billions and restrict sales of currently existing car models no longer compliant with new standards," unquote. But Pam Solo, founder of 40milespergallon.org, writes in an op-ed for the San Francisco Chronicle that the way to save Detroit is to save it from itself. Referring to the same Obama plan, she says a loan guarantee bailout to Detroit automakers should include requiring them to drop their four-year-long legal assault against global warming laws in California and the other states, an assault that influenced the EPA's ruling. Solo says a bailout should also demand that Detroit develop hybrids, clean diesels, and other fuel-efficient vehicles. Vehicles the public might actually want to buy.
Confronting the economic crisis and the climate crisis isn't a zero-sum game. It's just the opposite, a win-win. For the Corporate Watchdog News Analysis, I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Recently, Corporate Watchdog Radio spoke with Mark Fulton, Global Head of Climate Change Investment Research at Deutsche Asset Management, about the report Investing in Climate Change 2009, Necessity and Opportunity in Turbulent Times, that linked the environmental impacts from climate change, energy security, and the financial crisis. Now, we speak with Deutsche Climate Change Investment Research Director Bruce Kahn about the follow-up report, Economic Stimulus, the Case for Green Infrastructure, Energy Security, and Green Jobs. The report makes the case for creating a green national infrastructure bank. Bruce, the press is abuzz with talk that dealing with climate change, energy security, and the financial crisis are mutually exclusive. In other words, dealing with one prevents us from dealing with the others. Deutsche Asset Management's new report argues the exact opposite, that dealing with the climate crisis, energy security, and the financial crisis are mutually reinforcing, a win-win-win. Explain.
Well, great question. And our new report points out just what you said, that the confluence of the environmental impact of climate change, our need for energy security, and the current financial crisis offers us an opportunity to take a step back and look at what our national priorities are. And what we've done then is built upon the infrastructure bank idea that was put forth by Senators Hagel and Dodd to say that there is a sweet spot for this infrastructure stimulus, which could achieve both economic opportunities as well as promoting low-carbon opportunities in the area of energy-efficient buildings, the electric power grid, renewable power, and public transportation.
Now, a lot of people say that infrastructure is one solution to an economic downturn. And you're saying that this new national infrastructure bank that's been proposed should have green stipulations on it. What are those stipulations, and what impact do you think that they would have?
Well, you know, as a result of the idea put forth by Senators Hagel and Dodd, President-elect Obama picked up on that and said that we should have a reinvestment infrastructure bank. And what we as climate change research analysts say is that, well, if we're going to be deploying anywhere from $150 billion to more than that, as put forth by Senator Pelosi, we should be also thinking about the future costs of the carbon emissions from this infrastructure build-out. And we expect that carbon will have a cost in the future, and therefore, while we're going to be making these great investments today, we should be taking those costs into consideration. And by building a green infrastructure bank, that we would be able to achieve economic stimulus opportunities for our society, as well as promoting low carbon emission infrastructure technology.
Now, how would the bank do this?
The bank is, first of all, not a bank in the traditional sense. It would be a governmental-run program where you would have loans or direct funding or grants or tax credits that would then be distributed to either central governments or state or local governments and private sector partnerships, which would then allow the private sector to invest alongside with the National Infrastructure Bank.
So in some ways, this is consistent with what the TARP law, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, enacted by linking the bailout to a set of clean energy stimuli. So do you see the infrastructure bank idea that you're proposing being green? Do you see this as consistent with the way that TARP was structured?
Well, I wouldn't really connect it to the TARP as much as I would say that we expect the government to execute a economic stimulus in 2009. What we're saying simply is, when we do this, you should have standards and mandates within those policies that require the lower carbon emission technology in those grants and loans, etc. That should be a standard of which these projects are going to be evaluated in order to not eliminate but reduce the amount of long-term carbon emission cost that any project will have.
And in the report, you mentioned loan de-risking. What would that entail?
Well, because we believe that the long-term consequences of climate change will result in large economic costs, we feel that taking care of these climate change emission technologies today will essentially reduce the risk in the loans being repaid.
Okay, so the carbon component is essentially what you're doing to reduce risk?
Right. And, you know, a lot of the renewable energy projects today are financed by the private sector, and by providing governmental loan guarantees, it also reduces the risks of those projects.
So in other words, it's putting the government support in the first place instead of afterwards.
That's right. But it's not that the government will come in. It's that there'll be private sector partnerships with the government for these loan guarantees. Look, the point is that this economic stimulus that the future electric administration is proposing, they're going to do this anyways. We're just saying within these packages, you should be evaluating these programs for their low carbon footprints.
And you mentioned five initiatives: energy efficiency in building, the electric power grid, renewable power, and public transport, as well as water being one other attractive area. Choose one of those to just give a quick example of how this would work.
So developing renewable power or using electric power grid, if the government is going to be supporting the redeployment of electric power grids, we would urge them to say, well, rather than using old, you know, the kind of traditional technology, we should be upgrading our grids using smart grid technology, demand-side management, high-voltage lines that have lower line loss. So that would be an example of where the government would review a project, and if the project didn't include these types of technologies, that would be less competitive than a project that would have these technologies embedded in them.
Bruce Kahn of Deutsche Asset Management, thank you so much for speaking with us here on Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Great. Well, thank you, Bill, and have a good day.
That was Bruce Kahn. Check out Corporate Watchdog Radio for links to the two Deutsche Asset Management climate change investing reports. Next, we speak with Michael Renner of the World Watch Institute. Renner and fellow senior researcher Gary Gardner issued a proposal for the G20 summit to adopt a global Green Deal, evocative of FDR's New Deal, but more audacious in scope and vision. They lay out five strategic objectives: transition to a renewable energy economy, launch an efficiency revolution, invest in green infrastructure, make materials circulate, and work for fairer distribution of wealth within and across borders. Corporate Watchdog Radio listeners are familiar with the first three strategies, so we open by asking Renner to explain about material recirculation, sometimes called the cradle-to-cradle approach.
One of our proposals to pay closer attention to the need to making materials circulate is, I mean, you know, typically the reference that one gets in discussions is to recycling, and I think one of the problems is that many people relate recycling to just, you know, leaving, you know, a stack of newspapers and some other materials at the curb to be picked up by the, you know, by the garbage when they come around again. But I think there's a really much, much broader issue here in terms of seeing to it that what would normally be regarded as the waste products of one enterprise or one factory, seeing to it that to the extent possible, you know, that the valuable materials can be, in effect, really retrieved and can be used for other purposes. To some extent, this also happens really just within, you know, given industries. I mean, if we look even at what's already happening at, for example, the steel and aluminum industries, they have both been trying for a number of years now to increase the amount of scrap steel and scrap aluminum that they are relying on. Worldwide in the steel industry, this is actually as high as about 40% now. In other words, almost half is really recycled materials, and the other half is, you know, is newly made material, you know, made from virgin materials. You know, what's really important with regard to these efforts is that they, in the first place, they save enormous amounts of energy. It takes far less to recycle scrap than to produce any of this from scratch. And so that, in its own right, of course, would be of enormous help with reducing the overall need for energy in the economy. These kinds of efforts, you know, recycling and reuse, and also what is sometimes called remanufacturing, you know, refurbishing products and equipment, can really play a very, very important role. And my colleague Gary Gardner and I found that, you know, it really would be important to include this in a Green Deal, because it can just really make a very big difference.
As you say, a new Green Deal, a new deal. The old New Deal depended a lot on public works programs. You know, a lot of our libraries and our highways were, in fact, built during that time. You say this could also be a tool in the government's toolbox in both urban and rural settings. What kind of public works programs are you thinking about here?
Well, what we proposed, and it doesn't have to be limited to that, of course, is that in urban areas, you know, we were thinking that there is nothing wrong with using the notion of public works programs to help establish green belts, rehabilitate park areas, evergreen areas, helping modernize or to some extent maintain infrastructure, building biking lanes, pedestrian zones, and such. I mean, just we basically listed a number of ideas, and what's behind our thinking is really this notion that if indeed we are now going through fairly tough economic times, I mean, we'll obviously have to see how the next, you know, few weeks and months play out with this financial and economic crisis. But if so, you know, if that really does lead to quite a fair amount of job losses, then, you know, maybe we need to think a little imaginatively to say, well, how can we make sure that the people directly, most directly affected, you know, aren't going to just sort of fall through the cracks, in effect? You know, how can we accomplish things that need to be done anyway from an environmental point of view, and also offer people, at least in a transition period, at least for a short while or so, some options that otherwise they might really, you know, find themselves really being in a very tough spot.
Michael, in your proposal, you also talk about the fairer distribution of wealth within and across borders. Explain how that would help with the global Green Deal.
You know, I strongly believe that a greening of the economy is only going to have adequate support if people really see a stake in that economy. And I think one of the real problems we've had, of course, for a number of years, or maybe in some ways you could say really a number of decades, is that we've had such an incredible discrepancy in terms of, you know, average worker pay and CEO compensation on the other hand, and just generally, you know, a wide gap in terms of income and wealth disparities. And it seems to me, you know, asking people to perhaps do less, you know, in terms of material goods, you know, and to say, you know, let's orient our lives more in ways that can actually help sustain this earth that we're living on, that there have to be other tangible benefits that people can say, yes, you know, I actually see something here that's going to work for me. The other notion is, you know, if we do move forward, and I think we do need to do this, you know, with putting a price on carbon, with basically recognizing that, you know, the price at which fossil fuels are being sold is way too cheap relative to what they really cost and the damage they do, then if we go in that direction, that of course means that many, many products will, if anything, be more expensive, not less expensive. So they will be harder to afford. Now, that, I think, leads quite logically to the need to say, well, you know, we need to make sure that wages are decent, that wages are higher in many cases than they have been. Because otherwise, how can people afford something that is becoming more expensive? Now, in the long run, you know, you could argue about, you know, we'll have a transition, we'll move from fossil fuels to renewables, and, you know, with them being produced, you know, at a sufficient scale, you know, maybe they will be cheap enough. But that's something that we can hold out, I think, maybe a little more for the longer term future rather than for the immediate future. And so I think issues of, you know, affordability and giving people a sense of having a stake in the economy are really important. And I think that does relate very, very closely to this notion of a more fundamental fairness in the economy.
We've mentioned, and of course the backdrop to all of this is the financial crisis, and particularly the credit crunch. this credit crunch is starving even legitimate businesses and household needs, as you say in your piece, and it could trigger mass unemployment. So a whole lot of people are asking, where's the money going to come from? Where's the capital going to come from for a global green rescue effort?
Yes, I think that's indeed a very critical question. And what we do in our pieces is basically offer a number of ideas, and these are ideas that don't have to be limited as such to the particular list that we have. One thing actually that we don't per se go into, but I think that's in a sense almost implied, is if the new administration undertakes measures to counter this incredible gap in incomes and wealth, you know, via a more progressive tax policy, for example, going back on the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and super wealthy, that in its own right, I think, you know, can be regarded as a potential source of revenue for some of the things we are arguing for. But there are other things, and again, one that I think was quite prominent in the Bush years, you know, the exploding military budget, I think, is something that needs to be looked at very, very closely. We are running two wars that really, you know, aren't making us more secure, certainly aren't making us any more popular in the world. And I think these are both wars that, if anything, are well on the way to being lost by anybody's, you know, sane definition. So I think a major change in course in terms of, you know, overall foreign and security policy is in order, and I think doing that would certainly allow, you know, a fairly substantial reduction in military spending. We have a situation now where the United States is spending probably up to close about $700 billion per year on just maintaining, you know, the regular Pentagon machinery and in running these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, that's a huge amount that is being spent year after year, and I think taking at least some portion of that and devoting it, you know, to various ways to green the economy and to create more sustainable employment would be a really, really worthwhile undertaking.
$700 billion, that's about equal to the bailout that could pay back the U.S. taxpayer if that goes down. But you also talk about something called a Tobin tax. Tell us what that is.
Well, the Tobin tax, basically the idea was to levy a very, very small tax on foreign exchange transactions. And then, you know, as I say, there have been variations over the years, you know, where the notion has been, you know, let's put a fee on sort of any sort of speculative kind of behavior. And the idea really is to say, you know, even if it's a very, very small fee, you know, some parts of a percentage point or so, that as well would bring in some really substantial amounts of money, and it would actually also have the side benefit, so to speak, or maybe it's really the main benefit of tamping down on some of the sort of more speculative kinds of undertakings that we see happening in the economy.
Now, Michael Rinner, you wrote this these recommendations before the G20 summit. Now the G20 summit has happened. What's your take on the degree to which the G20 is signaling that they might be heading in such a direction after the summit?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think probably not too surprisingly, we don't really quite see the kind of pickup that we ideally would like to see. And you know, I have a feeling that the kinds of ideas we have laid out, and actually, you know, that others are also laying out now, and I should say, I mean, you know, if you look at what Al Gore has put out recently, or others like Van Jones from Green for All, or the United Nations Environment Program, I mean, there are a whole range of proposals now that sort of go in a very similar direction of, you know, speaking of a Green Deal of sorts, you know, whether on a national or international basis. I think all of us have to continue to make these kinds of efforts to continue to lay out these ideas and to point out the opportunities and the possibilities that are before us. You know, clearly these are not things that are going to happen overnight, and it will require some real dedicated effort, I think, to get us there. I've generally for long believed that, you know, change typically happens when there is sufficient pressure from the bottom up. You know, I mean, we talk about leaders, but I think very often, and there are exceptions, of course, you know, very often leaders are not necessarily the ones who are actually leading. I mean, they may eventually do the right thing. But without strong public pressure and a strong sense on the part of the public, you know, what the issues are, what the possibilities are, you know, many of these things may not happen without that.
Well, Michael Renner of the World Watch Institute, thanks so much for talking with us here at Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
The top Benny Award for 2008, given by the Business Ethics Network, or BIN, to activist campaigns holding corporations accountable, went to the Clean Up Ecuador campaign for bringing Chevron to justice for decades of pollution in the Amazon. The campaign is led by Amazon Defense Coalition and Amazon Watch. Mitch Anderson of Amazon Watch has our commentary today, produced in partnership with BIN.
Emergildo Criollo, leader of the Cofán people of the Ecuadorian Amazon, was only a small child when Texaco first arrived on his people's land in 1969. He remembers the helicopters, big metal birds, as he called them, hovering over the rainforest canopy, and the hordes of oil workers setting up camp in the forest, their strange language, machinery, and intentions. Emergildo and more than 30,000 other indigenous peoples and settlers soon found out what oil drilling would mean for them. Over the next three decades, Texaco made the cold decision to use Ecuador's Amazon as a dumping ground to lower production costs to the bare minimum. Texaco deliberately dumped over 18.5 billion gallons of toxic wastewater into Amazon waterways, about 4 million gallons per day at the height of its operation, poisoning drinking water sources with carcinogens such as benzene, and causing a public health catastrophe that continues to worsen by the day. This disaster has been dubbed the Rainforest Chernobyl. Texaco, as the sole operator of the oil production facilities, chose to dump its waste in Ecuador in ways that were illegal in the United States at the time. Whereas in the United States, standard operating procedure would have compelled Texaco to re-inject its production water into the ground, in Ecuador, Texaco never once did so. The U.S.-based oil company was willing to damage innocent people's health and their homeland by polluting in ways it would never have dared to in its home country. In thousands of pages of internal Texaco memos obtained through a lawsuit, there is not a single mention of any concern about the environmental impact on the indigenous people living in the region. Emergildo and other affected people have organized and fought back. Under the banner of the Frente de Defensa de la Amazonía, Amazon Defense Coalition, in 1993 they filed a landmark class action lawsuit against the company in the U.S. They used the Alien Tort Claims Act, originally used against pirates. It's now being used to bring U.S. companies to justice for human rights abuses abroad. Chevron inherited Texaco's toxic legacy when it bought the company in 2001. After 10 years of delay, the case was transferred to Ecuador at Chevron's request in 2003. Now a verdict is near in a small Amazonian courthouse. In 2008, a court-appointed independent expert recommended that Chevron be held liable for damages between $7 billion and $16.3 billion. A verdict against Chevron will have historic consequences that extend far beyond Ecuador. This case is likely to result in the largest environmental damages award in history. It also represents the first time that indigenous people have forced a multinational corporation to stand trial in their own country for violating their human rights. Too often, corporations operating in developing countries take advantage of weak environmental and human rights protections and/or weak enforcement. A verdict against Chevron will send shockwaves throughout the corporate world. A verdict against Chevron will send shockwaves throughout the corporate world. Corporations will know they can be held accountable anywhere in the world for despoiling the environment or violating fundamental human rights. The days of pollute and run are over. It's been a very long road to get here. In response to the case, Chevron promised a, quote, lifetime of litigation and threatened to avoid paying any damages. For local affected communities, delayed justice means that the suffering continues unabated. Emergildo lost two children to contamination. They ingested the toxic water from the Agua Rica River. His wife is recovering from uterine cancer, and his aunt recently died of mouth cancer. But against all odds, Emergildo and the thousands of rainforest residents have remained hopeful, and now they have the company on the ropes. The evidence is in, and a verdict is imminent. Justice is on the horizon. For Corporate Watchdog Radio, commentaries from BIN, I'm Mitch Anderson of Amazon Watch.
Check out corporatewatchdogradio.org for links to Amazon Watch and Chevron Toxico. Thanks for listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio.
We broadcast on over a dozen Pacifica and independent community stations nationally.
Tune in next week for more on sustainability and corporate accountability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.